journey on. The magic lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses through his transformational training program.
Just because he knows that you know.
G'day everyone and welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller and there's a bit of a long story about how I got to today's guest, but it really ties in with a lot of the themes that I've talked about here on the podcast. You know, I've talked about one of the podcasts we had was about manifesting things in a reality. And, you know, my son Tyler, he lives on the Hawaiian island of Oahu, which is where Honolulu is. He lives on the outskirts of Honolulu. He moved there a bit over a year ago. And he works there for a rock climbing gym. He's the lead climbing instructor there and basically the general dog's body as well. He does a lot of different things for the owners. And he divides his free time between surfing, rock climbing, free diving, hiking, swimming with sharks, playing music and, you know, just generally hanging out with other really adventurous people of his age. You know, there's a lot of people like him that are kind of adventurous and moved to Hawaii at this time of their life, and they have a pretty good time. And in hanging out with all these cool people, he has had the opportunity to go sailing a few times and really kind of fell in love with sailing as well. The being on the ocean, but the relying on the elements, the wind, and being able to read the wind and interact with the wind and the water, and it really, it's something he really, really kind of fell in love with. And so him and a friend of his recently, probably a bit prematurely, bought themselves a 26-foot sailboat. Now, he doesn't really know how to sail this sailboat. He's been out in some sailboats. And so he's probably a bit premature, but he knows a number of people through his, you know, all the friends that he has there who are experienced sailors but don't have their own sailboat. And so he bought this boat. And what he figured he'd do is he'd find guys who can sail but don't have a boat, and he'd say, "Hey, I'll let you sail my boat if you kind of teach me the ropes." And so he can, you know, the people that don't own a boat but can sail get to have a sail, and Tyler learns the ropes in the meantime. So that's kind of the introduction to this whole story. Now, completely separately from that, we have got a young lady from Colorado named Kendall who has worked for us since the beginning of January, and you know, she wanted to come and work for us and learn, you know, what I do with the horses and stuff. And I had told her, you know what, it's not like I have a full training barn, you know, it's not like I've got enough work to keep you busy. You know, we've only got our own horses here, and you know, they're not necessarily limited in what we can do with them, but you know, half of them are kind of fully trained, so there's not much to do with them, and the other half are not. We're not doing much with them. But so Kendall's been here for 6 months, and I've been helping her with what I can help her with and show her different things. But she said recently, you know what, I'd like to get a horse to start under saddle, you know, start from the beginning and have you kind of guide me through it. And I'm like, yeah, that'd be a great idea. So I put a post out on Facebook saying that we're looking for a horse for the Kendall to start under saddle. And I got a lot of replies back, and one of the replies I got was from someone saying, "Well, we've got a horse, and you know, she was about this horse is about 2 hours from us." And this lady said, "We've got a horse that would be good for Kendall. You know, we're not there right now. We're actually professional sailors, and we're not there right now. But if you know, I can tell you where to go get her if she would work for you." And so I'm like, professional sailors. So if you're a professional sailor, where are you? And this lady said, "We are currently in Honolulu. We've just raced the Transpac." And so I'm like, "What, the Transpac?" So I go and look that up. And the Transpac is a sailing race from San Pedro, California, to across the Pacific to basically Diamond Head, which is the volcano above Honolulu. My son, his house is almost on the side of Diamond Head. And she said, "Yeah, we're professional sailors and we're currently in Honolulu." And I said, "Well, hey, my son lives in Honolulu and he's just bought a sailboat and doesn't know much about it. Is there any chance I can have him, like, you know, come down, say good day, and maybe, you know, get a few pointers or whatever? And so Tyler contacts these guys, and the lady said, yeah, that'd be great. My husband, Jesse, he not only does he sail, but he teaches sailing too, and he loves to teach. And so I'm like, what an opportunity. So I tell Tyler, and Tyler gets their phone number and gives them a call and goes down and sees them. And the next thing, they said that Tyler contacts me, and he says, oh, I've met them, and they're cool, and they're going to take me sailing on my boat tomorrow morning at whatever time, you know. And I think this is a great opportunity. So the next day I call Tyler, and it was later in the day where I figured they've been sailing, they've had enough time to go sailing and come back. And he answers the phone, and I said, so, and I can tell from the background noise that they're back on the dock. I can hear things in the background. And I said, so how was it? And he said, how was what? And I said, the sailing, how was it? And he goes, oh, mate, we haven't left yet. I'm like, oh, no, what happened? He says, oh, nothing happened. He says, we spent the whole time re-rigging my boat. It was all wrong. He says, well, actually, it wasn't wrong. There was just much better way to do everything. And I said, oh, so you're like the person who brings their horse to a clinic who thinks they want to fix a problem at the canter, and we don't get out of the walk because that's where the problem lies. And, you know, they don't get to get ahead of a walk. And he said, Dad, that's exactly what it's like. And I did a post about this recently on Facebook, and then I quoted a German poet who may or may not have been a relative of mine, but he was born in 1759, died in 1805, but his name is Johann Friedrich von Schiller. And he has a quote that says, only those who have the patience to do the simple things perfectly will acquire the skill to do difficult things easily. And so after Tyler had told me about his experience with getting help from the skipper of this boat, I thought, wow, this guy's lived an amazing life, and there seems to be a lot of parallels between boats and horses. And so I said, well, do you want to ask him if he would be on the podcast? And he said, yes. So here's my interview with the professional sailor, Jesse Osborne. Jesse, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thanks for having me, Wark.
This is going to be fun. You know, in the intro, I told a story about the whole, you know, the horse and the Tyler and the sailing and all that sort of stuff. But I just got your email here this morning about the questions that you chose. And you said we've met before at a horse expo in Washington.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect you to remember it because you'd have like 1,000 people coming by your booth. But we were living in Washington at the time, actually rebuilding the boat that we just sailed here to Hawaii. And that was a 2.5-year project. And in the interim, this is when Sam was really getting back into horses, because we had a little piece of property near Port Townsend, and we actually built a little. It was more important to have a piece of property for the horses than really a place to live. So we lived in a camper and then built an apartment in our garage. And then we had 10 acres with 5 of it fenced for the horses. So anyways, about when we met, we went to the expo a couple of times when we were in Washington, and you were the, you know, one of the presenters, and went by and we just talked briefly about, cause I'd done a lot of dog training in the past, and you know, we probably had a 90-second conversation, but I remember meeting you. It was cool.
Did you have a dog with you?
No, I didn't have a dog.
That was the horse expo that everybody there had a dog. It was so cool because when I go away to horse expos, I kind of miss our dog time. Yeah. And it was great. I get to, you know, like, bring your dog over here. I want to say hi. That's a, yeah. If you regular podcast listeners, if you've listened to all the podcasts, you would have you would have heard me talk about a cat jumping in my lap at a horse expo and not getting up. And that was the horse expo that the cat decided that cuddling up to me felt good. So,
yeah, right on. Well, we had a dog with us on that trip, but I didn't have him when I was talking with you. We have a little West Highland Terrier, just a little monster. He's awesome.
Very cool. Well, let's get it. You know, this Journey On podcast is about people's journeys, and you have one of those occupations. You currently have one of those occupations that I would say is one of those passion-inspired occupations. It's not like something that people go to college to You know, right. You're not a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, you know. It's one of those yep. things that you follow your, you know, you're a professional sailor. So how'd you get to this point in your life where you're a professional sailor?
Well, to get here, I ate a lot of top ramen and a lot of cheap living. But the catalyst for that is actually I picked up sailing at the tail end of a really, really difficult time in my life. The kind of difficulty that you wouldn't wish on anybody, really. And so without, this could be a huge rabbit trail, so I'm not going to go all the way down it, but basically I was an Alaska State Trooper for 7 years. And early on in my career, I was going through a divorce. I got married too young. And so my life was already kind of conflicted, you know, and I loved my job. I loved being a state trooper. It was so much purpose there, you know, like bringing calm to the storm and just felt like I could really do some good in that job. And then one really dark and just a frozen cold winter Alaska night, there was a real bad guy that we got a call to check out his a suspicious vehicle, and he tried to run over the other trooper that was on scene he was stuck between a snowbank and his car, and a guy tried to run him over and I had to shoot him. And it was awful. Besides that just being awful was the fact that it turned out he was actually a really, really bad guy. I didn't know who it was at the time. And he was being investigated for a 3-yard list of crimes, from sexual abuse even within his own family to homicide and burglaries and everything. And so the investigation was so in depth that they wanted to do everything right, and they took a lot of time, and they didn't talk to the media, and it was really mismanaged in the relationship with the media, and it just became a real shit storm. It was awful. And so something about the media is that if you don't feed the sharks, they feed themselves. And basically they're going to get a story whether you give it to them or not. And it ended up just getting really bad. I was a real media nightmare, like lightning target, if you will. And I was in a custody battle for my kids and my divorce. And it got to the point, work, where I hadn't done anything quote unquote wrong, and I'd been exonerated by all the investigations, because it's that's investigated as a homicide regardless. A lot of people don't understand that it's investigated as a homicide until proven otherwise. And one of the things people don't get about police is they police themselves very well. So anyways, I made it through all that legally and everything, besides civil lawsuits, which always exist. Everything was fine, but it wasn't fine politically. And I got stuck in a hallway for about a year and a half and just stared at the wall, basically, with my patrol canine dog. And with all this political pressure and everything that was going on, I wasn't able to see my kids. I didn't have enough money to really buy justice when it came to all that. So without turning into a big sob story, I'm just trying to give you an example of like the level of difficulty I was up against. My hair was falling out, like it was bad. And I found myself thinking real hard about just eating my gun and just going away, which scared me really bad, because that's not me. I'm the guy that solves problems, not the guy. But I had no skills, man. Like I had no emotional skills. I had $1 million worth of training, and I had no idea how to handle, you know, anger, fear, and just all those emotions that I was just under a waterfall of, like a relentless deluge. You know, I was just absolutely drowning. And so I decided to do something different. I decided not to eat my gun. And I'm writing a book about this whole thing, because I think it's important to share your difficulties, the lowest point in your life, as opposed to just sharing all your successes. That's not honest. So I learned a bunch of things. I learned how to be better at everything I did and how to approach life differently. And how I started approaching life was devoid of public approval. I found that if I put all these people that met, that had an opinion of me but didn't know me, if I gave them the personal authorization to hurt me, that I was doomed. And I really had to dig down and find another way to live. And so honestly, this sounds kind of weird, but I think you're up for it. What I actually did was I started looking physically and mentally at anything that was bright and shiny. Anything that was good, to whatever the good news was. It didn't matter because there was so much black around me that I could not consume anymore. I don't know if you know anything about scuba diving, but once you're saturated with nitrogen, you can't come to the surface without getting bent, right?
Like in the bends, yeah.
Yeah, so it was like that. Like I was completely saturated with all these emotions and stresses that I couldn't take anymore. And so I started retraining myself to look at bright and shiny and happy things. And I decided that I wasn't going to kill myself and I wasn't going to quit. And if I thought I had done something wrong, it might've been different. Maybe I'd have just slunk out the back door and been like, oh man, you know. But that wasn't the case. What this was a political assassination. God, I could go on for hours and hours, but I really want to talk about horses and sailing. Why? Because they're the bright, shiny things in life that I now concentrate on, right? Okay, so long story short, I made it through all that. I made it through the whole thing. I jumped through all sorts of hoops. The union was no help to me. I took voluntarily took everything from psychological examinations to all sorts of training scenarios and everything, and they just couldn't put up any more roadblocks. And I got back to work. And when I was back to work, I was always officially a state trooper, but I was just stuck in the basement.
Your desk jockey.
Yeah. So by the time I got back to work, my job was now 10% of my life, and my life was the other 90. Mm. So I had gone the process of concentrating on everything that was good or bright and shiny and like challenging myself. I ran a marathon. I went to the gym. I learned how to cook like French sauces, you know, and I'd throw these parties for friends and like do like a 9-course meal and wreck every dish in the house, right? Like every dish, you know. I'm awful at the dishes. I just want to create. You know? So
I don't think you can cook really well and not use every dish in the house.
I know excellent. I can. Yeah, well, I'm in good company. So I just did stuff like that. I started riding motorcycles again and going on these big trips and everything. But I had to stay in the game. I decided that I wouldn't leave law enforcement by being forced out or wedged out or kicked out or pushed out by a bunch of politicians, essentially. I'd make that choice on my own. So I finally got my post and I'm going to work. So this is the long route to answering your question. So I was going to Southeast Alaska and I was talking with someone who had lived there before. And she goes, well, you're gonna want a boat. Like you're in Southeast Alaska, you're gonna want a boat. And in the back of my mind, I'd gone to a boat show once and I'd gone inside a sailboat and I was like, wow, this is amazing. There's like a bed in here and there's a little kitchen and look at this cool oil lamp. I'm like, I could live on one of these. And at the time my wife was like, no way, you know? So I'm like, well, that's it. Now's my chance, you know? And I knew I was gonna want to do something big. And let me, you know, just because I'd had gotten some things behind me doesn't mean I was exactly fixed, if you will. You know, I still had like, I was just keeping it together, really.
Yeah.
And so I bought this 50-foot sailboat sight unseen. And it was the most ocean worthy sailboat I could find that I could afford. And I bought it in Southeast Alaska and a crazy buddy of mine came down with me and we got on the boat. And I took it on a 250-mile trip in January in Southeast Alaska to Ketchikan, which is where I was working. And let me tell you, the learning curve was nearly inverted. Like, I mean, it was like climbing a glass skyscraper learning.
Did you know Did you know anything about sailboats at the time?
Nothing.
Oh, so you're just like Tyler. Yeah, I mean, so Tyler coming to you is like you coming to you.
Yeah, exactly. And now if I'd had some resources, I'd have taken them. I just didn't.
Right.
And I'd already faced so many problems at that point that like my scary wasn't scary anymore. And so I wasn't scared about the ocean. To me, I was on top of the world. I was howling at the moon, you know? And so that definitely pushed some recklessness that lingered for probably 3 or 4 years before I'd say I really started approaching things with what you'd call good seamanship. And what I loved about the ocean, though, and I learned this the first night, was that it doesn't matter how tough you are or how mentally tough you are or how physically strong you are or how bright you are. On your best day on the ocean, you are a guest there. You don't beat the ocean. You're allowed to be there and experience it. And the better you are, the more that you can do without things going really bad.
Wow.
That's a mouthful, I know.
That's quite the story. Can we go back a bit to the, you know, when you're having your troubles there?
Absolutely.
You know, so you had a lot of stuff going on, but I want to talk about the media part of it because, you know, I can have a slight perception of what that's like. You know, I've got 23 or 24 million views on my YouTube channel. You know, I'm in the public eye a little bit. I mean, in a very small part of the world, it's just the horse world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the most part, what I do, people are quite positive, but you get, you know, negative responses from people that don't know anything about you. Mm-hmm. And if you let it, and it's just, you know, it's perceived pressure. It's not real pressure because I don't have to listen to anything they say, really.
Yeah.
And I've struggled with that a little bit, but I can't imagine being the bad guy in the news to every single person who reads the newspaper or watches the TV or whatever. And do you feel like there's an energy that comes off of that, like a perceivable energy off that?
Oh, yeah. Now, to answer that, I'd say that people find what they're looking for. And so lots of people already have a notion. Like, you know, when I used to read the newspaper, and I haven't since then, ever, I'd read the funnies and the, because the funnies are great, you know, most of them. And I'd look at the classifieds because, you know, I'd like to like wheel and deal.
Right.
So that's what I'm looking for. Right. And if you're into hating on cops, then you're going to find that. And if you're into, you know, you name it. So part of it is that I can't really blame people for seeking out what it is that they're interested in, regardless of what their motivations are. Hey, that's what they're interested in. So I can't blame them for that. But I'd say the energy that comes off of it is directly related to the reporter and whoever is, you know, clearing their work and allowing it to be printed. And that is a powerful pen, that particular pen. Think about it. Say you're the editor of a paper, and I don't exactly know how a paper works, but I can imagine, and it's fairly straightforward, I would think, from this perspective, that you have a paper and you need to fill it up because you have subscriptions and you want print. And if you have a person, just like, you know, in business or anything, if you have a person who can deliver something that fills that square and they're not a pain, they're going to have quite a bit of input. So if you find someone that's extremely opinionated as a reporter and they have a work ethic and they deliver, they get to say a lot. It'd be pretty, I know that, like, I've worked with people and I've worked with contractors who, they might be a real pain in the neck, but if they can deliver, they might be worth the pay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And media people are masters at saying something without committing to having said anything. And I did a methods of instruction class years ago. This is when I was in the troopers, and I had done some training in the methods of instruction class. I did an example where I took two factual statements, and then I wrote two articles, one that was very positive and one that was very negative. Same information. Neither one of them's lying. Neither one of them's really leaving anything to, you know, voiding anything out, but hyper-focusing on the points of it that want to push their opinion. And then they layer their opinion in there with it, right? And so they're not lying. And this is how they hold themselves against libel. Wow, well, factually, this is true. And that's why you'll see a lot of the facts being very thin and the opinions being very thick. And so I think it's a complex subject, but I think the energy comes from the person who's writing the report or that article.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry you had to go through that, because that does not sound like much fun. But I think, you know, everybody I talk to who's been through something really terrible, it's been the springboard for all the good stuff in their life. So looking back, you've almost got to embrace it. And
yeah, there's no way I'd take it back at this point.
You wouldn't want to relive it, but you wouldn't take it back.
No, I wouldn't want to relive it. And, you know, whether it was just or not, which I have my opinions on that, it's our choice whether or not we extract the lessons that come with the pain. That's our choice. I could choose to be a victim about it. And believe me, I wanted to. It sometimes still do. Oh, yeah. You know, like, yeah. But it's my choice whether or not I cash in on that labor and that pain and take extract everything I can from it. Because that actually is the only thing I have control of. And so that's what I'll do.
Yeah. As they say, life is 10% what happens to you and 90% of your reaction to it.
Yeah. And you know, not all your reactions are always great. On your path to extracting all the good stuff, doesn't mean you make all the right calls, or you sometimes some of it takes just a long time to process, you know. Even a couple of years ago, this was a long time ago now. Even just a couple of years ago, there were certain things, if I talked about it, I'd just start crying or just grind my teeth, or somebody mentioned newspaper and I'd be just like, you know, like,
yeah.
So it's come in doses as I've allowed myself to see the positive side of what I've been able to extract from that. And I learned a lot about people. And so my relationships are way better, way better.
So that was your introduction to the sailing. So this wasn't like the, you know, because I've been, you know, around horses all my life. It's, you know, it's been a passion forever. But I was thinking you were going to say, yeah, when I was a kid, you know, I went sailing and I just always wanted to do that. But you've kind of come to a, you know, an occupation that most people would probably end up with because they had a passion for it as a kid. How old were you when you got the sailboat?
30.
How old are you now?
44.
Okay, so 14 years. So, well, so in 14 years, you've gone to, from not sailing at all to being a professional sailor, sailing around the world.
Yeah.
So tell us about, let's talk about the situation you're in right now. So are you the captain?
Yes.
You're the captain of this boat that's owned by a client of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a crew. Is that right?
Kind of. The boat is not that big. It's 47 feet. So my wife, Samantha, and I, our company manages the boat. So he's our client. So we do everything from, Samantha handles the logistics side. And we spent 2.5 years in Washington rebuilding this boat. And then he asked us to help him sail it around the world. So that's.
So at the time when you were building it, you weren't building it to sail it around the world for this guy. You were building it for him. And then he said, now do you want to help me sail it around the world?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Okay.
And we knew we'd probably help him on some passages, but we didn't really know what that was going to look like yet. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to make money in the thing that you love doing. And repairing boats was one of the things we've done. We've done deliveries, I've done teaching, and basically it's whatever pays. So you're doing the thing that you have to do while you focus on the thing that you want to do. And so we're at what we want to do, which is great.
You're so at the point to get, you're getting paid for what you want to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're basically retired.
Kind of, but we still have, you know, it's still not like we're like la-di-da sailing around. This is itinerary.
But, you know, when I was training horses for the public, people would say, so what would you do if you won the lottery? And I said, oh, I'd be doing what I'm doing now. I just wouldn't be doing it for other people.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'd be riding horses. I just wouldn't be riding other people's horses.
Yeah, yeah. So it's similar. So we're doing what we've been aiming at for a long time, basically. Doing what, you know, and when I quit the state troopers, my goal was to be a professional sailor. And I said, this is really great because after going through all that, nobody expected me to quit. But like I said, they didn't understand that I just wanted to get back to where I was working full capacity, no limitations, nobody's holding me back from anything. And the political tide had turned, and I was actually friends with the commissioner at the time and had all these opportunities, and I was on the dive team and all this kind of stuff. And I sat down and I wrote my letter. I said, serving as an Alaska State Trooper has been both an honor and a privilege, and neither of those will be forgotten. But if anybody should seek to contact me, I'll be at the helm of a well-trimmed sailing vessel just over the horizon on a course bound for adventure. Send. And they just blew their minds. I must have got 200 emails the next day. What? No way. No way. You know, like they're just blown away. And so there was something important there that why I brought that up was, is that I found that if you want to accomplish something that is really, for me, that was really off the charts, right? It was important for me to be a success after all that, just like not let it break me, you know, but make me stronger. And so one thing I do is I announce it. If I'm going to do something that I'm not quite sure I can pull off, I announce it. And that's my accountability.
Mm.
And I knew I would need that. And so I was just kind of like, and maybe that's a social motivation. I've kind of outgrown that now. But at the time, that was a motivation for me, was that everybody understood that I'm leaving of my own volition. Pardon me. That I'm leaving of my own volition, and that I will succeed. And so I set about that. And in the interim of becoming a professional sailor, I worked as a truck driver again, because I drove truck when I was younger. I worked as a mechanic in the Arctic on the North Slope. I would paint someone's house. I would, drive a tow truck, whatever was required. And then when I had enough money to go back and do some more sailing and like build my resume, I would do it. And I just worked like that forever, really, until I met Samantha.
Was Samantha a sailor when you met her?
She was. So we have a really interesting story. I don't know if you've heard it from, I don't know if Tyler told you.
No.
All right.
No.
So this is awesome. This is awesome. So after I left the troopers, my sons, I have two sons, Isaac and Steven. They're all grown up now, you know, and they're launched. Yes. This is just awesome, right? You know what I'm talking about. Like they're going to make it, right? And now we're friends, which is really cool. So anyway, I was back and I had moved back to my hometown to be with the boys, which is just awful. Going back to your hometown after everything I'd gone through is just like, ah. But I was teaching sailing there.
Where is your hometown?
Seward, Alaska. I'd call it my hometown. I spent probably the biggest piece of my life in one place. That would be it. And so anyway, I was teaching sailing and I really wanted to do something big. And they didn't live in a very good environment. Without getting into it, I wanted to extract them. I wanted to take them away from that place and I wanted to show them the world. And so I said, I was trying to come up with something and I'm teaching sailing. And I read this book called North Into the Night by Alvis Simon. Great book. And he talks about going up into the high Arctic and freezing in his boat for a winter in a place called Tay Bay. And it's a fascinating story. And his book is very honest. And I loved that about his book because he talked about his failures too. And so I learned about this place called the Northwest Passage. And I said, oh, wow, this is amazing. Like at the time I read that book, there was like 150 people that had ever gone through the Northwest Passage. I said, well, that's for me. That's what I'm doing. Because I had to make a big gesture, right? This is all back to that email, right? I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going. So I have my boat, same boat that I'd had in Southeast Alaska, huge boat. I bought a too big of a boat to learn on, really, but I learned a lot. And so I set this, I was talking with one of my sailing students, and the guy said, I'm going to sail the Northwest Passage. And this student of mine asked me a very important question. He said, when are you going? And I was like, I thought for about 30 seconds, and I go, I'll probably need 2 years to get ready for this. And it was 2011, I said. 2013. I'm going in 2013. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I said I'd go in 2012. Right. So I actually ended up going in 2013, kind of. So that was it. I had announced it, right? So by God, everything from that point on was like paying my bills, child support, all the stuff I had to handle. I lived in a 30-foot beer van. It said Budweiser on the side. I built a 10-foot apartment in the front of it. The last 20 feet was a shop with a workbench, and I started building parts for my boat and going for it. I had a real job. I was working as a mechanic on the North Slope and driving truck up there and whatnot. And so I was making money, but it was all going towards the project. And people didn't get it. You know, I had a $300 pickup truck. I called it the mashed potato, you know, like the stick, it was stick shift, and the stick shift had come right out of the transmission. Like this thing was, you know, it was legal, and that was about it. So anyway, the story about how I met Sam actually happens in the Northwest Passage. So in 2012, I sailed my boat from Seward to Kodiak, 250 miles away. I was out of money. Went to the top of the dock. I had enough to pay for a month worth of mortgage. And I said, who's hiring? The harbor master came down and said, well, I got 3 cords of wood in my yard you could split. And I was like, he's like, great. He's like, what do you want? I'm like, buy me a ticket to the North Slope. So I split these cords of wood and stacked it. He bought me a flight to the North Slope and I went back to work. 2013, I came back and sailed up into the Northwest Passage. So the Northwest Passage would be, I left Kodiak Island, went up through a place called Falls Pass on the route of the Aleutian Chain. All the way up to Bering Sea, we stopped in Nome. And my younger son did that leg with me from Kodiak to Nome, Stephen. And then kind of switched crews. I had a hodgepodge group of friends and people that also wanted to go. And then my older son, Isaac, and I, and kind of a different crew, went up, we went around the Alaska Peninsula and up over, north of Barrow, and sailed the Arctic coast all the way up into Canada. And I decided to stop the boat there that year. I had a really bad leak in my rudder post develop. And the crew was kind of discombobulated because we'd gotten a hold of some internet along the way, and half of them were going to get a divorce and all this kind of stuff. I said, okay, we're stopping. Well, I'd already made this choice to stop. So we're sailing into a place called Cambridge Bay. Unbeknownst to me, there's an airplane flying above. A turbine beaver on bush wheels that was being flown by Samantha. She's a commercial pilot. And Samantha was flying in the high Arctic doing surveys, and she was surveying muskox. She was on a contract working for a company. So it was her, and there was a biologist that was flying with her, and they would fly what they called transects, and they just basically like mowing your lawn. They do a grid and count the muskox and turn in the reports and everything like that. So she did all this high Arctic flying and landing on skis and floats and stuff and super remote diamond mines, and she has all sorts of cool stories.
Wow.
So she was
a sailor. You guys are a pair of adventurers, aren't you?
Oh, man. Learned that. If you want to find your partner, go to the place where you would find someone else like you.
Yeah.
And which is a total accident. And full honesty, I was dating a girl at the time, but it was just another mediocre relationship. So I had to make a really awkward phone call when I met Sam. I was like, yeah.
Sailing up there. She's flying around overhead. How did you guys actually meet?
She saw my boat. So she flew over the boat. It was tied to the dock. We met within hours. And my buddy Jason, who was along with me, he actually met her. Said, "Oh yeah, you got to meet the captain. You got to meet Jesse." And so we met, and then our first date was sailing. Pardon me. Our first, like what you'd call a date, was sailing around on our little sailing tender, and there was the wreck of this boat called the Maud, and it was an old Arctic sailing ship that was owned by a guy named Roald Amundsen, and he was the first guy to go through the Northwest Passage, and I'd studied him. So her and I sailed out there, and we sailed around, and I was fascinated by her because she was the first person I met where it wasn't just like a physical attraction. I was like, oh, you can hang. Like, this is someone I want to get to know. Like, I want this person in my life, right? Of her own volition, her own skills, her own drive. She was already doing what she wanted to do with her life. And so we met, and I was very frank with her. I was like, what would it take to be in a relationship with you? And she says, honestly, marriage. And she thought she would run me off. But it was just the opposite, because I had been in back-to-back relationships where it's just kind of, oh, we'll see how it goes. We'll have a good run, you know? And so that was like music to my ears. I was like, all right, you know? And so the next year, her and I came back. Of course, we had the border to overcome for getting married. But I gave her,
the border. So she's Canadian?
She's Canadian, yeah.
Okay.
So that was a trick, you know, the whole other story. But anyways, the next year, her and I sailed from Cambridge Bay out the Northwest Passage, which was extremely difficult. It was one of the worst ice years in the last 50 years, is what the locals told me.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What time of the year did you sail up there?
You got to make that passage between July and September.
Okay.
September historically is the most ice-free month out of the year, but in the years that we went, it never, quote unquote, opened up. You're basically like leaping from lily pad to lily pad of open water, trying not to get run over by the trucks. If you think about Frogger, I know you use some old school video game references. Yeah. So Northwest Passage is just like Frogger. You jump from open water to open water, and all the trucks and cars and alligators, that's different types of ice that move in different ways. And so that's exactly how that works. So her and I made it to Greenland, though. And we were the 208th boat in history to make it through the Northwest Passage. That includes icebreakers and cutters and everything. It was really a massive undertaking. Just awesome.
Wow. That's a crazy story.
It was awesome. Yeah. I got all sorts of crazy. I got a terabyte of footage about the stuff. But people are like, oh, what was it like to sail the Northwest Passage? I'm like, I have no idea. It was like 1 foot in front of the other, man. And wobbly, you know. We'd make all these rules for ourselves, like, okay, we're not going to hit any ice, you know, and then like 20 minutes later, okay, ram pieces of ice that are smaller than the boat and try to get them out of the way. Like, there's no manual for that. You just have to like figure it out. And thankfully, Empiricus, I chose well. She's really tough, really tough. So we were on a good boat.
Wow. That's a crazy story.
It was crazy. It was also awesome.
And so, okay, so you met Sam there. You guys ended up getting married. Then where do you go? You know,
we went to we got to Greenland. We made landfall in Greenland, and then Samantha had to fly out right away to make the appointment for the mail order bride visa we were using to get married. And I stayed there and negotiated some. We did a lot of bartering. So I negotiated some bartering to keep the vessel stored in Greenland for the winter, because it was going to be really expensive. I did some diving and repaired some railroad track at the ship lift was the trade.
Okay, let's stop there for a second, because you mentioned diving with the troopers as well.
Yeah.
So you scuba dive in ice cold water.
Yeah, you use a dry suit, though. It's not as bad as it sounds. Just in the face region.
Just your face
freezes.
That's
still cold. Yeah, your face and your fingertips. But if you have the right equipment, it's not bad. It sounds bad, but it's not.
I have got no experience, but slightly more than most people because I take ice baths. And how cold the water were you diving in?
In Greenland, it was extraordinarily cold because it was actually ice saturated. So there was ice in the harbor we had to look out for while I was diving. But it was shallow. But the problem there is there's something called hykaline where you get the salt water starts blending with fresh water. And what happens is that the ice melts, you know, the fresh water is a little bit less dense than salt water. And so it lays in a thin layer on top. And that's the coldest water because that's the fresh water that's come off of the ice. And then you have a visibility issue where the two blend. It almost looks like, it's hard to describe. It's not bubbles, but it bends the light at different rates.
Right, yeah.
And so we had a visibility issue you had to get below. So that those particular dives were, you know, 34 degree water temperature. And that's brutal cold. It's awful. You have to be working a lot.
34 Fahrenheit.
Fahrenheit, yeah.
So 1 or 2 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, cold. That's cold diving.
Yeah, well, I've actually had my ice bath down to that cold.
Yeah.
Once.
Yeah.
It's pretty darn cold.
Yeah, you go about your business and you get out. So Samantha would be in the support vessel, which had the hydraulic equipment that I was using to cut the railroad track, and we had a cooler full of hot water.
Oh, hang on. Well, let's back up a bit. When you said you did this job and you were diving and then you were cutting this railroad track, I thought they were two different jobs.
So this isn't in the Troopers. This is in
I know. But
Greenland.
What's the railroad track doing under the ice cold water?
Oh, so in World War II, the Army Corps of Engineers built what's called a railways. They basically, you know, Greenland had a bunch of chemicals that we wanted for the development of aluminum. And so we said, hey, we'll put military bases on Greenland. So we did. And those remain, but they're now in private ownership. So this is a U.S.-built military shipyard. And how you would haul a big ship out and how they still do in Greenland and some places around the world is you have railroad tracks that are laid underwater on a very gradual angle. And then you basically send a car down with, you know, some supports on it.
Yeah.
And then you adjust those supports as the boat is floating. You know, you adjust it. And then you pull the car up with the boat tied off and then, you know.
Just like on a boat, like a boat on a boat trailer comes out, really.
Yeah. It's like a trailer on railroad tracks, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was thinking there was actually a train in this place. And I was thinking, how did the tracks get underwater?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now
no,
I get
no, trains there.
Gotcha now.
Yeah. So that was cool. And, you know, it was interesting. I didn't have much for money because it all went to that. And I think that was one of the best things about that whole journey through the Northwest Passage and Greenland and everything is that there's something in the air about sailing that I'd really like to dispel. And one of them is that you have to have a truckload of money. And there's something that can be very off-putting about like a kind of a, not a prudish thing, but definitely like a click kind of a thing that just involves money. The whole, I'll just say yacht club kind of sums it up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Some yacht clubs are cool, but we all know what that means.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we didn't have much money. And that was actually one of the best things. You know, when I showed up at the dock in Cambridge Bay, this guy comes up to people trying to sell me stuff. And I'm like, look, I don't have any money. You know, but, you know, maybe I can help you out if you help me out. So this guy loans us his car. And I'm in his basement and my buddy Jason and I are doing plumbing in his basement because he didn't know how to do any plumbing, you know. And then, like, I'm using this internet. We're painting the kitchen, you know. And we were friends, but it was also an equitable trade. We had something to offer. So I developed relationships based on this mutual, you know, like, there's like we end up babysitting the guy's kid and he'd stayed out on the boat. We watched cartoons. It was weird, you know, like, but that's a village, you know, the communities raise kids in the village. And so then the next year when Samantha and I come back, we're in a completely different town and his friends got a hold of us there, met us in this completely different village. And Sam got invited to a baby shower or a wedding party. And, I got to tell you this really great story because this kind of sums up the kind of unique relationships that you get when maybe don't have money, but you put your best foot forward and you just meet the coolest people. There's a 96-year-old woman in a place called Tuloyuac that her granddaughter, we'd met her through these mutual friends and we would go to and do talks at schools. And so I met this lady. She barely spoke any English, and she's on this four-wheeler. And I would go to the dump to get parts because in the Arctic, there's no hardware store, but also nothing gets shipped out. So there's cars and pumps and everything that breaks goes to the dump and it's kind of stored there, right? So it's kind of nasty, but there's also a lot of good hardware there, right? So I got fascinated with these Arctic dumps because they're just so cool. And I get some footage of them, you know, and maybe grab some parts I needed. It was just cool. So here's this 96-year-old woman. She was born in an igloo. And she is on Facebook. One generation. Talk about adaptable, man. So I say, hey, would you give me a ride to the dump? You know? And she looks at me like, why would you want to go to the dump? Just scornful, you know, like, God, you know? And then she kind of shakes her head like, all right. You know, I was like, all right. So I jump on the back of this lady's four-wheeler. And her foot is like cobbed up. She can barely shift. And she's reaching for the shifter and she's trying over and over. And I go, you want me to shift? And she just nods because she can't really speak much English.
And I go, what gear do you want? What does she speak?
She's Inuktitut. So it's an Inuit language.
Okay. Yep.
And so she holds up three fingers, right? So I reach down and I go, click, click, click. And she drops the hammer. I don't know, what is it, a 450 or 500 Ford or Honda. And she just, whoop, I thought we were going to flip. We're going around the little grocery store in town. I swear we're on two wheels, man. And we're just getting it. And it's a dump in Tulalip. It's like 7 miles away. And we're just hammering down. So here it must have been July. It was late July. And we're doing like 50 and kind of squirreling around on the road, you know, like this. She's got it buried. And it starts snowing because it snows every month of the year in the Arctic. It starts snowing, but it's gravel road. And the snow starts caking up on her face and her glasses. And she keeps the throttle buried. And she takes her glasses off and hands them to me, puts her hand right back on. Just whoop. And I'm on the back of this thing and I'm cold, man. Like, I'm like, this place is so good for me because I thought I was tough, but I'm not. This lady's 100, almost 100, you know? Yeah. So that just puts in perspective. Those are the kind of people that you meet when you ask to go to the dump and you make relationships with someone that's 100 years old. You know, her daughter showed us, was her daughter or her granddaughter showed us where her parents were born and took us out to these tent circles where the rocks were all lined up. And like, these are experiences that you only get through true relationships, you know, and that exchange, like that bartering system or just being part of the community, going, talking to the schools, playing football with the kids. That was the best thing about that whole trip was stories just like that. It was awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot to take in right there. I can just see her. She sounds like some of the old Mongolians Tyler and I met.
Oh, I bet. Very similar. Yeah. Real cohesive family.
Yeah.
And adaptable people.
Very adaptable. Like, it's probably similar up there, but, you know, in those climates like that are the very inhospitable, like in Mongolia, the nomads do not lock their houses.
Yeah, it'd be similar.
And if you've left it and someone comes by, they're allowed to come in your house and mm-hmm. eat what's on the stove or whatever, and they don't knock. You don't knock. You just walk in. You just open the door and walk in. That's pretty amazing. So where'd you guys go from there? I mean, because you're still not professional sailors yet. You're sailing for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Besides teaching the ASA courses, which, you know, it's not that hard to get that kind of a credential. We sailed from there to Greenland, and then the next year we came back to get the boat from Greenland. And we met this big steel boat. It was a family that also wanted to go through the Northwest Passage. And so we traded charts with them. They were an American family. We traded charts and gave them some advice, the things that we had learned and things like that. And we were continuing on to Iceland and they were going the other way. So we sailed down the west coast of Greenland through a place called Prince Christian Sound, which is just super cool. It's kind of like the Strait of Magellan of Greenland.
Okay.
And it's tough to get through there, but we got through. We made the way across to Iceland and we hauled the boat out there with the crane. Hauling the boat when there's no boatyard is always really interesting. You have to get creative. So twice we hauled the boat with a crane And that's kind of a whole nother story, but it's a fun process. So we hauled the boat there and then we flew back to Seward where we live, because that's where my boys were. And we decided to be where they were because I couldn't really extract them and take them with me. You know, that just, there's too many things to compete against.
Okay, slow down for a second. Where are you right now?
Well, we left the boat in Greenland and we went back to Seward, Alaska.
Oh, all the way back there. Okay, because I've just got a map up here on the computer. And
oh, yeah, we flew back and left the boat there.
I've just realized that Greenland is basically above the very east coast of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And Alaska's on the – so basically you've sailed halfway around the world through ice stuff. So you've gone up over through the Beaufort Sea. Northwest Passage is basically above Hudson Bay then.
Oh, way above. Yeah,
but I mean, it's on that far over. You were talking, I'm thinking you're still up cruising around the top of Alaska. Gotcha. You've sailed halfway around the world through ice.
By longitude,
okay.
Yeah.
And wow.
And there's so many micro stories in there. I don't want to just be like, oh, yeah, then we did this and then we did that, because I love this. I'm loving, and I hope we have time to get to this comparison between the horses
and
the sailing, because it's so good. But so yeah, that's what we did. And there's a point on there. If you're looking at the chart or Google Earth or something, if you type in, why can't I think of it right now? It's not Cape Bathurst. There's some narrows. I hate it when I think of something and I can't think of the name, but basically it's the northernmost point in North America. And it'll come to me in a minute and I'll tell you. But anyways, we had to go through a really narrow spot because the Northwest Passage didn't open up that year. And there's basically kind of a river that runs just above the northernmost point in North America that you can sneak through. Bellot Strait is the name of the place. Bellot. And named after one of the early explorers, Bellot. So we made it through Bellot.
Is that between the top of the U.S. and Greenland?
It'd be the top of North America and the next like archipelago. I'd probably have to give you some coordinates, but Bellot Strait was really brutal and we had a lot of heavy, heavy ice contact. There's a lot of current there and big multi-year ice. That was probably the most challenging section. And we ended up about 74 north latitude, 74 degrees north is about as far as we went north. But we came back to Alaska to answer your question. We came back to Alaska and, then we did a short stint where Samantha was flying. She is still a commercial pilot, but she doesn't actively fly anymore. But she had given her word that she would do a contract in Indonesia. So we spent about 2 or 3 months in Indonesia, and she was flying a Dornier over there for a company called Susie Air. So we spent some time there. And then when we came back from there, we came back to Seward, and we met those folks who we'd traded the charts with in their big steel boat. And they offered to sell us their boat. And we decided, since we were in Seward where the boys were, that we would run a charter boat, a sailing charter boat. So that was a 65-foot Bruce Roberts cutter, which just basically means a giant money eater. And we fixed it up and painted it up and built a website and did pretty high-end charters out of Resurrection Bay. But we decided it wasn't for us. It was a lifestyle business, but it lacked the exploring.
Did you sell the other boat?
Nope. It's in Ireland right now.
Okay.
And we're going to go breathe some life into it. It's pretty beat up from all the ice and everything. But it's in a place where we can keep it affordably. And when this COVID craziness is over, we'll go resuscitate it and do something with it. But yeah, so anyways, we ran that for a few years. And then our business developed into a boat watch business where we took care of other people's boats for them. And I did whatever jobs I had to when we got back to Seward. I worked at a cannery. I did whatever I had to. And anyways, we ended up picking up the client that we have now in our boat watch, and he wanted a bunch of boat work done. And we'd become a dealer for engines and stuff. And so I put a new engine in the boat, and one thing led to another, and he wanted the whole thing rebuilt. And we took it to Washington to do that because it's just a better place to rebuild a boat. And we spent 2.5 years rebuilding it. And I upgraded my license to a globally recognized all oceans license. And now we have this contract. And it all sounds very simple. There's about 10,000 steps in between, of course.
I can imagine.
But
But so you have this contract now, and so how much time? So you guys in Hawaii right now? I said that in the intro, and where you're going to go somewhere? Well, you leave Hawaii in a week or so, whenever that is, when your sails get repaired. Where do you make landfall next?
Well, our plan was to go to Australia, but it's closed because he wanted to race the Sydney Hobart. So
really?
We're just going to, that's the next. He has a bucket list of races. So we race the Transpac. He wants to race the Sydney Hobart. He wants to race the Fastnet in Europe, and he wants to go around Cape Horn. The races, personally, Cape Horn's the most exciting thing for me. I'm really, really excited about sailing Cape Horn.
Yeah.
And so we're just going to go back to the West Coast then, and then we're going to go down to Mexico for the winter, and then we'll assess in the spring, but likely we'll just go from there down around Cape Horn and then up to Ireland and race the Fastnet. And then maybe we'll race the Sydney Hobart on when we come around through the backside back towards North America.
The Fastnet, where's it from and to, and how long is it?
That's a good question. It's out of Ireland, but they have changed the ports, and I haven't researched in those details. I just know it's over there out of Ireland. I think it leaves from Cork, but I have to.
And where does it end up?
It's like a 2.5 day race, work, and I'd be making it up. I have to look into it because I'm not sure where the finish line is. That's so far down the road. I'm like, whatever. When we get there, there's if you're going to plan well for the present, it's kind of like the focus is fuzzy on something like that, and my edges are really crisp on going back across the Pacific right now. That's kind of how I plan.
Yeah, no, it's just, like if you're going to race the Sydney Hobart, that one's pretty simple. It starts in Sydney and ends in Hobart,
Exactly.
And this other one, I thought you might know where it starts and where it finishes.
Yeah, it starts the Fast and goes to the Net. It just doesn't work like that. I'm not sure. It's a really infamous race. It's hard to get into. There's like 600 boats in that race. And there was a huge storm in that race one year that unfortunately a lot of people were lost. Mm. And I almost think that that's the appeal to it now.
Really?
Because it's super popular. It's an interesting deal. Yeah.
The seas down there can get kind of crazy. Like that one year they had that big storm. But Cape Horn is the, don't they call it the Cape of Storms or something or other?
Yeah. I mean, there's no, unlike the Northern Arctic, there's nothing in the way. There's no breakwater. So the storm systems just wrap the globe over and over and over and over. Yeah, really excited about it.
You didn't have to dodge any icebergs in the Cape Horn.
Well, if you go too far south, you would, but yeah. I'd really like, you're so close to Antarctica, and that'd be a great opportunity to go to Antarctica at the same time. So I'm working on the owner.
Is there something similar like the Northwest Passage in Antarctica?
No, there's no people. That's the only bummer.
Mm.
But it is Antarctica, and it'd just be cool to go there and land. There's some old whaling stations and stuff like that, but it's only scientists down there. I think that's the only bummer about it. But hey, it's a different place, right? Like, yeah. So you can go there, but there's no like inside passage or anything. We would just go there and probably get out of there, try not to get clobbered by too many storms.
Right. Interesting. So what an amazing life you've lived from it. So tell me about the dog training when you were a trooper. How did you get into the dog training? Were you kind of an animal guy before that, or was it part of the job?
No, actually, I was a real go-getter. And I liked it. We had pets.
You were a real go-getter. I figured that already in the conversation. There's not much slows you down.
Well, my lieutenant was awesome. He was a great dude. And, they put me on an assignment and I would just go for it. And so I ended up with a lot of really crummy cases because of that. Because, you use the right tool for the job. And, I'm 44 now. You can look at my face. Like, people can't see my face, but I look like a child. And when I was...
There's not a wrinkle on this guy's face.
When I was 24, I really looked like a child. But I was also a state champion wrestler, so I knew how to handle myself. So there was a certain aspect of people that just couldn't stand me. You know, get some guy that's been to war and he's got four beers in him and he's knocked his wife around and I tell him he's going to jail. Like, it's going to be a fight, you know? And so there was a dog that was a problem dog. And he was a little Belgian Malinois. And I think this dog had a legitimate, I'm not being too hippy-dippy here, he had legitimate PTSD that he responded to through aggressive behavior.
Hey, Jesse, can we just pause here for a second? This is the Journey on podcast. This is the home of hippy-dippy, okay? So, you know, we talk about past lives, astral progression, astral projection, you know, out-of-body experiences. So, you know, like a dog story is not going to scare anybody off.
So I think he had PTSD. I don't know where it came from. You know, a lot of these dogs get bred like in puppy mills and they get selected from thousands of other dogs for all sorts of uses, from like military Schutzen style training to police work. And there's varying degrees in what kind of departments use what type of dogs too. And we taught our dogs through, I don't even know how much I should get into it. Well, I can get into it in good conscience. I don't like to give away secrets that might get a dog or a handler hurt. On the
Please
street.
Do That's not kind do of that.
Yeah. But you teach the dog through training to make its own decision based on what you have taught it. So you leave a large amount of what happens up to the dog, and that's only as good as you spent training the dog. But anyway, so I got this dog that was a real problem dog, and he and I got along fine, totally fine. I could climb in his kennel with him, and he was fine. This is a Belgian Malinois. He's about a 65-pound dog, and he was an absolute hammer. He would, an agitator wearing a hidden sleeve, he'd hit them at 30 miles an hour with 600 PSI of bite pressure, and you wouldn't even hear him coming. He was just an amazing animal, but something was messed up in his head. And he had already bitten a couple of other handlers pretty bad, like for no reason, just out of nowhere.
Yep.
And it happened to me too. And this was a bummer, you know, like things were not good. My ex-wife made a lot of problems for me when everything went down. But the one thing that she did not ask for and she did not have coming was that dog bit her. And I always felt bad about that. Bitter for no reason. She didn't do anything. She wasn't doing anything wrong. This was the dog the department had given me, and they chose me because they thought he had a rank issue and they thought I could sort him out because I was a go-getter, right? So he was a difficult dog. They're like, well, Jesse can handle him. And I could. And, you know, it was my choice to have him out and around the family because I was trying to, things were going really well. At some point, you have to introduce a dog to your family because it can't live in a kennel because the dog lives with you,
right?
You know? So anyways, the dog bit her all over the hands and I grabbed the dog and I threw him on the ground and I lost my shit, actually. Was yelling at the dog and stuff. And then the dog, of course, responds to what I'm doing. Mm. And he could see the scar on my forearm. He punched through all the muscle layers on my forearm. And I was able to get him into the car and lock him up. And I never saw the dog again. It was fine. But they gave me a new dog. And right in there was when our divorce ensued. So, you know, law enforcement asks a lot of its people, and it is not easy on families. And most of the cops that I knew that were married before they became a cop did not stay married, but they would end up marrying like a dispatcher or an EMT or something like that in that group of people that have seen a lot of ugly things. And you can share the ugliness of the world that you see with them without like destroying their view of the world and happiness. So that's a whole nother topic, but I felt bad about that. Her hands got bit up and she healed up okay. And I eventually healed up okay. And they issued me a new dog and he was awesome. His name was Chusta, which means leader in Kodiak Aleut.
Really?
Yeah, it was cool.
So tell me about where'd the horses come in?
Yeah. So, I had almost no experience with horses. We lived on a ranch for a year in Oregon when I was a kid. We'd ride the milk cow, and that's about all I knew. And I thought it would be cool to have a horse when I was a kid, and I got a dirt bike instead because in Alaska it'd be pretty tough. But Samantha is an unstoppable horse force.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and so when we met, I actually asked her about horses because she was talking about horses all the time, and I was kind of concerned because I was like, I'm thinking, okay, Sam and I are together and we go on the ocean. How's the horse thing's just not going to work? So I actually brought it up early. And she goes, you know, I've had a couple of horses, like it's a new time in my life. And she was totally lying to herself. You know, she's like, I like she's done. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. I don't even need to finish my sentence. Right. So anyway, when we were in Seward, I got a couple good horse stories for you that show you how I came on board. When we were in Seward and we're running the charter boat, she just really wanted to have horses back in her life. And there was this guy who had a couple of fjord pack horses that hadn't done anything in like 5 or 6 years, nothing. They're just in their round pen. So she takes me over and all I have in my head is dog training, right? Like this completely different thought process in training. Some of it's similar, like timing and things like that, of course, but I don't know how a horse thinks, right? Or didn't. Tell you. So we would go riding and I got on the horse, you know, and it's like, all right, tell me what to do, you know, and we did some round pen work and some lunging and stuff. I'm like, all right, cool. And I'm a fabricator, like welding and stuff is one of the things I really enjoy. So I'm really interested in like the shoeing and, you know, blacksmith stuff. Cool. You know, I'll find my niche in here somewhere because I want to back Samantha, right? Like, She backs me. If you're going to be a team, you got to be there,
yeah,
you know, for each other 100%, you know? So I'm like, all right, how can I find my niche in this horse world? Well, ultimately, like we love doing everything together. I don't want any time away from my wife. Like, so it took so long to find her. Like, why would I want to have time away? So I'm on this horse and we did a couple rides and sometimes it went well, but it was so intermittent. We'd go do like a charter and be like a month and we come back and we have 2 hours because, you know, we have to, we're fixing boats on the side just to pay for the boat. We're basically subsidizing people's vacations on our boat at this point. And so this one day we get on the horse and I just wasn't feeling it. I wasn't happy about being there. And I was like, Sam, I'm just going to get off and walk the horse. All that fjord horse wanted to do is eat. I mean, all it wanted to do is eat. And it knew that it was in total control. You know, I was like, doggone it. This I'm a rookie and it knows it. So I got off and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to walk this horse around and just like show it where to go. You know? So I reverted to what I knew about like dog training, right? Wrong answer, Warwick. This was bad. So I'm like, yeah, now we're going this way. Now we're going that way. And it could tell that I wasn't happy. I didn't want to be there. And it was like, the horse started running. I was like, oh, you want to run? I'll run. So I'm like running and I try to get to stop and I pulled on the lead rope. And I remember seeing this flash of a hoof. Right in my face. Woo. I could like feel the wind off this hoof. And then I heard this crunching and felt this god-awful pain, like a tiny freight train going 40 miles an hour, crushing me in the ribs. And I just kicked me right off the end of the lead rope, like bam. I landed on the ground. I wasn't even sure if I was going to be able to breathe. And I breathe in. And the first thing I said on that first breath, I hate horses. I was so mad. I was like, I was so worried, Warwick, because we're starting this business.
All right.
We had this massive amount of debt and I was worried about the bill besides the injury. I was like, I have to work with my body. And I'm laying there and we call the ambulance because I didn't know if I had a punctured lung. And I'm actually having a discussion with the ambulance crew. Like, how much is this going to cost? If you guys give me a ride, see, my car is like 2 miles away. Can I walk there? So finally I get the ride and I'm just like, I'm worried about math the whole time, you know, and I should just be worried if my lungs punctured. So anyways, it didn't actually break it cracked a rib or two, but it didn't like, you know, splinter anything, which I was thankful for. And I had to work the next day. It was awful. So I was mad about the horses. But Sam persisted and was like, I just want a horse. And I'm like, all right, all I want to do is learn how to handle them safely. This was my only goal. Am I going too much of a monologue? Because it's
no, I'm okay. I'm listening.
Right.
I'm listening.
All right, good. So we knew we were going to move to Washington. We're like, you know what? We're leaving Seward. Stephen was coming with us, and we're helping him buy a little piece of property. And we're leaving Seward. My son Isaac was on his own. We're like, we've been here long enough. We're going to sell the charter boat and go. And so we actually took a trip, and we went down to Varian Arabians, and Samantha, there was this little horse, and she'd gotten some money from her grandparents. And she's like, I'd love to buy this little horse. And he was a problem horse, you know, but nice little horse. And he was nice. I was like, all right, great. So she buys this horse. We hadn't even moved yet. And it was the next year before we got down to Washington, we could actually take delivery and get the horse. And so she had her horse, and we had our garage and a camper and a round pen. And she starts working with him and doing all this stuff. And this was about the time she discovered your videos. And she started talking about it. And I was a little bit disgruntled about getting involved with the horses and the whole kick thing. I hadn't forgotten about, certainly. But I also was like, okay, I can't avoid this. Like, I'm going to be around him. I need to learn more. And then she found another horse. And this horse's name was Cleo. I love Cleo. Cleo's my favorite horse. And we picked up Cleo because we tried goats, and I think you guys might have some goats too, but we were working too much, and they were just so much trouble while we were working. It was just the goats. I sold the goats to a guy.
Like, no, we didn't have goats because Tyler's done some amazing planting of bushes and flowers and all sorts of stuff around here, and if we had goats, they would be eaten. So, yeah, no goats.
They're so much trouble. So I'm sure they'd be fun if you're there all the time or something. I don't know if you have a petting zoo or something. But so we got rid of the goats as a companion. We're like, we really need a companion for Henry, which is her little Arabian. And she was making good progress with him. It was fun just to watch. And I'd video her, and, you know, and she'd look at it. And so we go to Port Angeles, and we pick up this poor mare who's living in a field with a goat. And her feet were just pancake flat. No concavity. She had a laminitic episode, and she just looked awful. Her tail had been chewed off. She had been used a brood mare, and the place that had her, just, it was bad. But the people we got her from had adopted her or bought her just to get him away from there, basically. And she was in much better shape than when she got him. Really nice little family that had him. Their kids were going to college. They couldn't have the horse. And so we bought Cleo, and we brought her home. And so now we have Cleo and Henry. And then we're at the point where we needed to sell our charter boat. And the boat's in Alaska. And the broker that we were using at the time wanted us to bring the boat down to Washington. So naturally, I'm the guy that delivers boats between Seattle and Seward. I'd done that, you know, 15 times or something through the Inside Passage. And Sam had done it with me for 4 or 5 times. And but I had to keep working because we had all these bills to pay, and I'm the one that does the building most of the time. So get this. Samantha gets on an airplane, flies to Alaska, puts her 65-foot boat in the water, and puts a crew together, and she's bringing the boat to Seattle, and I'm with the horses. How'd that happen? So I was like, all right, this is some sort of divine intervention or just bad luck. I'm not sure which one yet, you know. But I'd been seeing some of your videos, and I'd been working really hard. Like when we got Cleo, I was like, okay, I realized early on that there's a difference between going through the steps and like focusing on your breathing and truly letting go. Because I couldn't get any progress unless I actually let go. There's no masking anything with the horse. All those coping mechanisms that I'd like developed, like to get over the stuff and the troopers and stuff, that is a veneer. And so what I started realizing was that even if I was agitated, Sam would be like, come on, come work with the horse for a little while. I'm like, come on, I got stuff to do. You know, like I want to ride my motorcycle or whatever, you know. I'd be like, all right. And I go out there. And I could not deny the fact, after about 4 or 5 times of practicing, that just the focus for relaxation, that's all I was working on, because that's what I saw you do at the expo. So I was like, I'm just going to do that. And I want to see if I can get her to let down. And what I realized was, even if it didn't work very well, when I came away, I felt good. Because it was the only time I think I have ever made in my life not to just be, I'm not a real hangout on the couch guy anyway, But to truly make room for and prioritize letting go. I do it on the ocean when I need to sleep. I actually have a little weird like version of how I meditate and clear my mind. And I started doing that and it worked. And I was like, oh, cool. So I started getting something out of it and I got more interested. And then Sam goes to Alaska. And so I had the horses for 3 weeks on my own. I'm doing every picking their feet, which I was just like terrified. I'm not scared of a lot, but I was like, I know what this little hoof can do to me. Yes. It's bad.
You have met the hoof before.
Oh, yeah. So that was really good for me to look out for him while she was gone, because I had to kind of complete that relationship loop in order to be successful. And I was not going to be calling Samantha saying, you know, like whatever, something happened with the horses and it didn't go well, or one of them's hurt because I did something stupid. That's not supporting her. Right. So I was motivated to learn more and it was great. So yeah, I don't hate horses anymore.
Oh, that's good. You know, the thing about, you know, with the horses, sometimes people are very motivated, but in order for it to work, when you're working with the horses, you have to lose the motivation. You have to lose the expectation and just, you know, there's a quote I use a lot, like at clinics and stuff, and it says that the most spiritual of the ancient Hindu practices is something called karma yoga, and karma yoga is focusing on a task with no thought as to the outcome of that task. And for someone like you who gets shit done, you know, that outcome of the task is a lot of times in the front of your mind, and having to let go of that and just be in the process. And I mean, you can't build anything without doing that. Like, you're doing this bit because we've got to do this bit, you know? But it really gets you to be in the moment. But there's also the other part, the very healing part of it too, to where doing the things with the horse to help the horse helps us a lot too.
Yep.
You know, even as a byproduct. You know, I've talked about a lot before that a lot of people, you know, I get a lot of emails and stuff and say, hey, following your stuff, you know, it really, not only has it helped the horse, but it's changed my life and I'm different with my husband and my children, my coworkers or whatever. And for the most part, those people would not put that much effort into changing for their husband or their children or their coworkers or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's, people are motivated to get along with their horses, and then it kind of has a bit of a knock-on effect to every other part of their life.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And actually, one of the reasons why I was even interested in looking and watching your videos with her is I saw the difference in her first, because she's owned horses like on and off
her Samantha, not her the horse.
Samantha. Yeah, I saw the difference in her, because you know that having the horses at home, this was the first time she had ever kept a horse at home. And I was like, there's no reason to have a horse if we're not going to have them on our property. Like, let's just do it all the way, you know? But I saw the difference with her, and because she would do all the focus for relaxation, because she's very accomplished. She wants to get on the horse and she's an excellent rider, you know, and she loves that experience. But with her little tricky Arabian Henry, that just wasn't an option. So she was looking for something more when she found your training. So I saw the difference in her personality was, and she was more calm and just more, I could just see it was positive for her. It was also positive for me. So at first it was probably helping me more than the horse. You know, they're probably like, gosh, what's this guy with the weird energy? And like, why is this guy always bringing his hangups over here? But I found as I actually started to relax for real, then Cleo would start to relax, and it got to be really fun. And not like a challenge, but a little bit of a game. Like, I wonder if I can get her to let down from this distance or whatever. And I really enjoyed it. And so something really interesting happened when Sam had the boat. She was about halfway back. So she's in the middle of Canada somewhere, coming down the Inside Passage. And Sam texted me. She said, the farrier is coming by tomorrow to, you know, to trim their feet. I'm like, okay, what time do I need to be there? And she's like, this time. Okay, so I stop work, drive home, meet the farrier. Farrier shows up. trims her hooves, and I'm asking him about shoeing and stuff because I want to be able to do that. And they weren't shod at the time, but I was asking questions, just barefoot trims, and so he's trimming them and stuff. And they're both tied up to the round pin, just hitched onto the round pin panel while he's working with them. And I'm like 15, 20 feet away. And he's all done, but he sees a little scratch on Henry's, the pastern or something. It was right down there by the top of his hoof. And so he's going to go get something to put on it. I want to say it's Fear Zone, but I don't want to.
Probably Fear Zone, like yeah.
It's
yep.
like a yellow pasty.
Yep. Fear Zone, yep.
So he was going to get this stuff. And he was explaining he's going to put it on there, and we're talking about it. And we started all of a sudden talking about the county and how permitting for the county. And he had this real horror story about how his neighbor complained about his driveway, and then he ended up having to spend $12,000 on wetland surveys, right? And so he got really mad, right? Kind of like probably I was when I got kicked, right? He just got mad. And Henry's like a little radar, right? He is bright and he is in tune. And he walks back and he has a finger full of this yellow stuff. He's going to put it on Henry, and we're talking. He's talking, and he's pissed. He's talking about this whole $12,000, and it was awful, absolute injustices. He comes back, he goes over to Henry. He's just going to put it on his front hoof. And his hand, I watched his hand go out, and he's talking, same tone, everything, same. Henry's just standing there. And his hand lands on that lead rope. I mean, like touchdown, like a fly's feet. And as soon as that happened, Henry lost his mind. He stands up on his hind legs, and he's ripping up with his head, and he's pulling the round pin panel up off the ground, and the pins are jangling around. I'm thinking he's going to break this panel loose. And the guy backs up, and his eyes are all white. And this is a professional. Like, he's trimmed Henry like 10 times, right? And I'm like, oh, shit. You know? I'm like, oh, yeah, Sam's not here, right? I'm like, oh, man. You know, I started listening to the story.
Yeah.
He's going to break his neck and all this is going to happen. I have to call Sam and the farrier's never going to come back and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, no, don't listen to the story. I know that enough, you know? So I walked over there and I was just like, I tried to remember what I'd learned from watching you and what I'd practiced with Sam. And I just went, oh. And I wasn't calm, but I knew I needed to get calm. I knew I couldn't pretend calm. I needed to get. So I got as calm as I could. Three breaths is always good. By the third breath, you can typically calm yourself, you know. And at third breath, I like put my hand on the lead rope, and Henry's still on his hind legs. He's like a ballerina dancer up there. And I look up at him, and his little black eyeball is looking right down at me with his head cocked, you know. Like, and I am like, I'm in it, you know, what if this either works or not. And he kind of comes down, and he lands on it, and he keeps looking at me, and I close my eyes. And he just kind of snorted a little, kind of shook it off, and I touched his neck. And the farrier's behind me like, what the hell was that all about? You know, and everything like that. And I was like, wow, here's a professional horseshoer, good at this job. He spends all day around horses. He looks like he's fairly healthy, which is some kind of a miracle anyways in my mind at that time. But he doesn't speak Arabian. And I thought that was just awesome. I was like, okay, so work. That's when I was like, I'm in. Because now I have tools, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm in. And it's been cool for me ever since. The horses are great, you know? And Cleo's feet are better. And I went on like a 15-mile trail or 10-mile mountain trail ride with her, like up cliffs and all sorts of stuff. And she really takes care of me. It's not because I'm any good at it. She looks out for me because we have that relationship,
yeah.
You know? Like, I'll fall off for no reason, you know, like, I have so much to learn. You know, I squeeze with all the wrong parts of my body, and I'm used to riding motorcycles, and I'm a wrestler. I have this weird ingrained posture that has nothing to do with horsemanship, and she'll, like, I'll be on the ground. She won't go anywhere. She'll just look down like, what in the world are you doing down there? It's just been awesome.
Yeah, oh, that's really amazing. Good. Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, you, like all my podcast guests, have been through my 20 questions that I stole from Tim Ferriss's Tribe of Mentors book and chosen some that you would like me to ask you. And we
We've possibly, you know, a lot of times by the time we get to these, we've covered some stuff in.
Yeah.
Covered them. But first question you chose was, what's the most worthwhile thing you've put your time into? Something that changed the course of your life?
Working on my relationships with my boys, not quitting. Just not quitting. People told me to quit. They're like, you can't deal with like the brokenness in a relationship with their mom and how toxic that was, the whole thing. And the opportunity cost of being a father is extraordinarily high, especially if you don't have a unified front.
Yeah.
And that happens in divorced couples, but it also happens in married couples where they have their own way. And if you have a unified front, then you can really launch a person or give them the opportunity to step forward into life. But I'm so glad I didn't give up on that. And it was hard. I gave up a lot of great jobs and opportunities and sailing opportunities. And I could have actually been professionally sailing a long time ago. If you look like what we talked about with my sailing career, I didn't become professional until they were both out of high school. And there's a reason for that. It's because I couldn't make long-term commitments. I couldn't be on some boat. I could go for months and that's about it. And then I needed to be trying whatever my new idea was. And it's not just because it was my responsibility. It's because I love being a dad. And even though the version I ended up getting of it wasn't what I hoped for initially, I talk to my boys every day. And they call me because we're friends. We have a real like meat and potatoes relationship. And they'll ask me for advice, and they know that if I don't know the answer, I'm not going to BS them, and just all of that, you know. We'll get in these little texting loops where we're just messing with each other, you know, and it's just fun, you know. And I'm excited. I've told them for years. I was like, someday you guys are going to have some crackpot crazy idea, and I can't wait for that call because I'm there. Definitely.
I don't know if Tyler's told you about, but he. You know, for his graduation, when he graduated college, we had planned to backpack across India, is what we were going to do. And he decided, yeah, I'm not sure I want to go to India. And so there was nothing planned. And then I got the call about this, you know, this riding camels across the Gobi Desert in the middle of winter thing. And so I called him to ask him, and he said he was in the library at college, like he was studying, and he gets a call. And so he says to his friends, oh, I've got to go outside. So he goes outside and I say, hey, do you want to go to Mongolia in January and ride camels across the Gobi Desert? And he's like, sure. So he said it was surreal. He said, I went back inside and sat down next to my friends and said, Dad just called and said, I'm going to ride camels across the Gobi Desert in the middle of winter. You know, it's like.
That's awesome.
The crazy idea. Yeah, I you know, when you're, I mean, I only got one child, but, you know, when they get to where they're grown up and you're best friends, it's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I learned some things from them now, you know, because you can only really be an expert in one or two things, you know, and as they kind of find their own way and start getting into things, they know a whole bunch of things that I don't. They're outside my scope of what I put my time and interest to. And I love it. They're finding their own thing. I'll call it a thing. Like, that's not very descriptive. But yeah. I always told them when they were younger, I said, look, until you have something that you're into, you're going to do my thing. And your thing is not going to be video games, just so you know. And I just made them go out there. And it was like begrudgingly so many times on the sailboat, you know. But we did some epic trips. We took a 250-mile trip when they were 5 and 8, and we went around this big island on Ketchikan called Revilla Judeo Island. And you know, that I didn't tell anybody where I was going. Like, somebody called the Coast Guard on us. We were fine. It was kind of embarrassing, you know. And and anyways, you know, I probably took 300 pictures on that trip, and those are some of the most prized pictures we have. And I got back to town, and there were people that lived in that town and owned a sailboat for 30 years, and they'd never done that trip, you know?
Right.
I was like, why? It's right there, you know? So I don't regret any of that, even though it wasn't always pleasant, because they'd be like, I don't want to go or whatever. It's looking back on it.
You know, it's funny you said, you got some pictures that are some of your prized possessions. You are currently recording this podcast in my son Tyler's bedroom.
Yeah.
And if you look over your left shoulder, I think it would be, there's a picture on the sitting over there of...
The one in Mongolia with the campfire?
Mm.
I was just, he and I talked about that. I was like, what a great shot. Like, I have something similar with Isaac. Like, here's you. There's mountains in the background. Here's your camels in the background. And the photographer is excellent. Like, the fire is frozen. And there you are wearing animal hides. And you might as well be on the moon. And that's not even... This is not a tourist punch a ticket experience. That is very clear, right? And I have this picture just like that with Isaac and I. And we're about 20 miles offshore. It was 11 miles, I think, offshore, because there was only a thin gap between the northern coast of Alaska and the ice. Very thin. Mm. The rest of it was hard pack. And we were sailing through this little slit, if you will. And we found this ice floe, and we tied up to it with ice screws. We tied the boat up. We got off. We had a fire. And
on the ice.
And you can collect fresh water off ice too, which is really interesting. And we took a swim, got some GoPro footage of jumping in, you know, next to this underwater with the ice. It was awesome. But then the best part of that was I got this picture, and the polar bear thing is real. They eat people. So this is not like a joke. So I had a 12-gauge shotgun, and so here's Isaac and I, and we're wearing this neoprene clothing, and we have these beanie hats, and there's a fire in the background. It's so reminiscent of this photograph of you guys. And here we are. We're standing there, and we're wearing ice cleats, and they're, like, dug in, and the boat's tied up to the ice in the background, and it's all there. And here, you know, here Isaac's got this shotgun, you know, and I'm standing around him with my arm around him, you know, and it click. Like... That moment in time was a culmination of a decade of constant effort, you know? And it was just so cool. Like, I love the photographs. Having the evidence and, like, reminding yourself, you know, of, like, your time well spent is just so motivating. It's just awesome.
Yeah.
I'll send you that picture.
I'd love to see that picture, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, next question. What book do you recommend to people? Not necessarily your favorite book, because you did mention a book before that inspired you to do the North Post Passage. Mm-hmm. But is there a book that you recommend to people that you say, you know, you should read this book?
Yeah, regarding sailing, read your engine manual for the boat.
Did you tell that to my son?
No, not yet. I did talk to him. He, you know, he has a brand new outboard and he's figuring it out a little bit. But we will talk about
laying it on the wrong side the first day he got it.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
I love that.
And then he hadn't read the manual and you're not supposed to lay it down and all the oil leaked into the cylinder. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm not saying that just because of his experience. I'm saying it because I've dealt with lots of people. I love teaching people on their own boat because I get to teach them all about the boat, not just a sailing thing where you have some turnkey boat. I love it. But while you're learning how to sail and control the boat safely under sail and actually make it where you need to go, not just where you want to go, you know, you're going to rely on that engine. And so what happens is typically people will say, yeah, let's go out sailing. And you're like, all right, great. And they're like, you know what? Don't worry. If like it gets too windy, we'll just use the engine, right? And I'm like, oh man, number one, on sailboats, the engine either gets used a lot or not very much at all. So people that never really learn how to sail just motor the snot out of it. So it's probably worn out. Or it's been sitting and rotting because they didn't use the boat at all, right? Now, an active cruiser will do a fair amount of both because they usually have an itinerary and somebody has a plane to catch. And so there's no wind, they'll motor on flat water or whatever. But what happens invariably is on a sailboat, the engine rots before it wears out typically. And there's a few things that can really shut you down and cause a hard time. One of them is the fuel, right? And so I try to show them, this is like your body. You know, how well are you going to sail today if you go eat like a moldy breakfast? You're going to be sick as a dog. You're not going to run well at all. So the fuel coming in has to be clean. So a typical example of a problem like this would be somebody buys a boat and they go drive it around on flat water for 2 months and it's fine. And then there's some rough weather one day because they're getting more brave. And the rough weather stirs up all the sludge in the bottom of the tank and they suck through a fuel filter. And because air molecules are smaller than liquid molecules, air gets sucked into the fuel injection system and it has to be rebled manually before it'll start again. But they don't realize that the battery is really crummy because the engine's always started really fast for them because they only had to crank it a couple times. But now that you're bleeding the fuel system, you have to crank it a little more. Maybe it's dead. Or maybe they never used the sails and they motored all day and they didn't realize the battery was shot because they always started the engine when the boat was plugged in at the dock and they shut it off after it was plugged in. So they just didn't know the battery was bad. So I would say read your engine manual and everything that feeds the engine so that while you're learning how to sail, you can actually rely on that engine as the backstop that it is in your mind. Because you already think it's going to be there. And there's nothing worse than like thinking something's going to be there and be like, your backup plan is utter failure. You know what I mean? And most people's backup plan when they start sailing is to motor. So good, that's fine. Make sure you know how that thing works. When I deliver a sailboat from point A to point B, the first thing I do is unplug the boat and see how long the batteries will last. If I can't start the boat in the morning, then there's new batteries or I don't take the boat. There's a reason for that. Like I've got stories behind all of this, right? And the other thing I'll do is make sure that I've got piles of filters, which just makes the owner squirm because they're like, what? This many filters? Yes, this many filters. I'll even offer to buy them off them at the end, but they have to have them on the boat. And the next thing I'll do is I will prime the fuel system. So I'll manually suck air into the suction of the diesel side, start my stopwatch, and time it and see how long it takes me to get the motor started after priming the fuel system. And I've got a story for that. But read your manual and make sure that you can actually fix some problems. One being priming the system and two being that you know that you're going to get good, clean fuel and air and it's actually going to run.
You know, it sounds that sounds a lot like horsemanship as in... You know, one of the principles of training is they need to know the answer before you ask the question. And you know, you need to know that that battery is going to start again when you're not plugged into the dock. And, yeah, that's – I think you made a good point about, okay, the thing you think you're going to fall back on, you've got to make sure that works before you need to fall back on it. And that's, you know, that's kind of like they need to know the answer before you ask the question. Yeah. Okay, what – you probably covered this, but what accomplishment are you most proud of?
Launching my boys, I'd say, comes into the same thing. Which question number was that anyways? Because I took some notes. It was some things I wanted to pass on.
What question number was that one? That is question 6.
Yeah. Constantly working on my relationship with my boys, like, and all just learning how to prioritize that. Gosh, it's so varied. Like when I think about accomplishments now, I used to think about it like a moment in time, like there's some mariachi band waiting for you when you're, you know, getting to the end of some journey or something like that. But I think the best thing I have done in my adult life is I've really learned how to learn and really learned what that means to be teachable and how to learn and how to add humility to every lesson. And because that's put me on a rocket ship for success, really.
Wise words.
I don't know if I can consider that an accomplishment.
Wise words. Okay, so what do you do to relieve stress?
I love to teach. So when I get, you know, we're on this boat, like I manage the boat and I run it around and stuff like that, but it's not necessarily a teaching scenario. I love it when I meet somebody, and sometimes I'll meet someone on the dock or something, and I have all this, I have all these hard-earned lessons in me. And there's a reason behind everything that I teach somebody, especially about sailing or whatever. And you meet somebody who's enthusiastic and primed to learn, and you get to pass on this really cool gift of maybe saving them from the awful hard way to learn it. And they don't even realize that, like, they might be launched a decade ahead of learning everything the hard way, even if one or two things sticks. I just get a lot of gratification of that. Maybe it de-stresses me because there's a lot of purpose in that, in like sharing your failure and how to get around that failure. And I always try to share the failure with the reason why I'm teaching, so they understand the weight that it carries. But I love teaching. I used to coach wrestling. I loved coaching wrestling. When I taught ASA sailing courses, I loved that. So anytime I'm able to teach somebody something that I legit know, and I teach them to the level where I'm at, which is, you know, not necessarily mastery, but I know it's going to be a boost. I love that.
That's cool, because I was wondering, you know, for those of us who get to do for a living what we love, which normally would be someone else's stress relief, I was wondering what you're going to come up with as far as, you know, what does someone do for stress relief who for a living does some other guy's stress relief, you know?
Yeah. Well, do you find that like, how do I put this? I was wondering if, because you do what you love for a living, but you don't necessarily get to do it in exactly the same way that you would if you were just doing it for you, right? Like, it works in the framework of what pays. Because that's what I find. I find I'm doing what I love, but it's not exactly what I would be doing if I just had a big fat bank account and I was going sailing. It's a little different still.
Totally. There's a Japanese term, and it's like a Venn diagram, and it's like what you're good at, what people will pay for, what you're passionate about, what fills your purpose, and there's this thing in the middle, and I think it's called Ikigaki or something like that. And it's interesting because I think anytime you add you do it for a living in there, it's not necessarily going to be exactly how you would do it. Otherwise, but speaking of that, whatever that Venn diagram is, what is your true purpose in the world?
I believe that my true purpose is to display the fact, show people through action that our lives are an absolute gift. Like,
round of applause, that's just the way it is. For Jesse right there. That's awesome.
And I see people that don't get that, and I'm always trying to like show them some way to see it, but it's up to them. So we can enjoy that gift, and this is why my story from the Troopers is so important in my life now. People need to understand that you can enjoy that gift regardless of the onslaught or the difficulties or the terror in the world. Look, like, we live in America. We already won the lottery. Oh my God. You know, just being in Indonesia with Samantha when she was flying, I was like, wow, that was a big lesson for me. And if I can show people, this is the point of my book too, if I can show people that, you know, here I was, this young, absolutely broken man, not able to see my kids or anything, strongly contemplating suicide, like, I realized, Warwick, this is a better way to say it, there is no rock bottom. So I used to think there's only one way up from rock bottom. And now I'm like, no, there is no rock bottom. There's always a deeper level of hell. My experience as trooper, sure, that's really bad. For America, I mean, you know, there are kids that get their leg blown off, you know, in a landmine when they're two. And, you know, or just all sorts of hellacious things that happen to people. Yeah. So I give this advice from a very privileged point of view. Sure, yeah, it was really bad. Great. But it can always be worse. And so, you know, when I decided to keep living and start concentrate on the bright things, I was like, all right, at this point, like my faith and everything was shaken. And I was talking to God, like legit, I was like, okay, God, I was like, I don't know now if I'm a total screw up. I don't know if I'm going to heaven or hell or whatever, but I do know this. I'm alive. Thank you for my life, and I'm going to enjoy it. And I'm not going to necessarily enjoy it like, oh, hoorah, like just go party hardy, but there's still purpose in what's going on. Just because things were a total train wreck in my life does not mean that there was not joy to be found, and it didn't mean that I lacked purpose. And so, like, this is just like, this would be a good analogy, I think, and I've used this one before talking with people. I've shared this thought of mine a few times. Say you're a dad, and you buy your kid like, when I was a kid, my favorite toy was a dump truck. I had a Tonka dump truck. I mean, it was awesome. You know, the yellow metal dump ones, truck.
Yep.
Right? It was awesome. I had a bumper sticker on it from Jerry's Rogue River Jet Boats in Oregon. It was cool. And I put my knees in that thing, and I'd go roasting down our driveway and crash and stuff. And that thing just, it was awesome. I broke the window out in the back so I could put a G.I. Joe guy in there, you know, so he could drive, yeah. You know, like it was awesome. And I really got my money's worth out of that dump truck. And I loved it. And I don't even know who got it for me, but I'm betting that they watched me play with that dump truck and they're like, that was a good gift. You know what I mean? But I've also seen kids, usually it's just from straight up spoiling, and it doesn't necessarily have to do with how much money they have. It has to do with how they're treated. I've seen kids open up like these unbelievable gifts and then complain that it's the wrong color or whatever. And what a slap in the face, right? I believe in God. I'm not slapping God in the face just because my dump truck was purple or something like that. I'm going to rock that. I'm going to ride that dump truck down a driveway and I'm going to enjoy it. And that really, learning that was, I think, the catalyst for many of the amazing things that came after. I just love it. I wish I could live to be about 400. I'm just figuring out what I love. And I look at all this stuff and sailing and horses, and I'm mathematically breaking it down to in trying to prolong the life of my body now that I can continue to experience the things I want to experience and do the things I want to do. It's just the opportunity now that I have a little more wisdom is just way more rich, but my clock is winding down. I'm 44, so I'm not old, but I better get with the enjoyment part, man. Because like, that's why I said, thank you for your time at the beginning of this, because the time you shared with me today and the time that I shared with you, we don't get it back. So that's why I have this motto. That's Ecclesiastes 9:10, which is,
showed me a tattoo on his arm.
I'm a foul mouth sailor. All right. I'm not saying I'm like all like, look at me, but I understand that the gift of life, and I do. And I believe in God. And we don't get our time back. We don't get those moments in time back. So that's my motto, which is whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, because there's no work, device, knowledge, or wisdom in the grave where you're going. Like, this is your run. So are you just going to enjoy it? I'm not just talking about like the partying part. Are you going to grow? Are you going to accept the lessons that come with the difficulties? Are you going to then take that momentum you've gained from your lessons and pass it on to somebody else that is thirsty for that? Are you going to create opportunity for other people like was created for you or not? You're going to ride that dump truck down the driveway and enjoy it or not. So I've made my choice. And it's actually worked out quite well. Like, I'm really enjoying a great life just because of that simple philosophy. And the fact that because I want that bad enough, I'm willing to suffer for it and suffer in the righteous way where you just show up and do the work, man. You know, pick up the sander. I know your shoulders hurt, but fix the boat because you're probably going to be sailing on it. Do a good job. Show up. Be reliable. Be good for your word. Say sorry when you screw up, which you will. That's all the best stuff in life. And that's how all the great relationships come about. Like, without that, you just, you know, you're just along for the ride. I want my money's worth.
Why was this? You're just rocking that purple dump truck, aren't you? Okay, so we've got one more question that you chose. And, you know, I've mentioned this before, but it kind of speaks to the kind of people that I get on the podcast, because most people would not want to discuss this particular subject. And there has not been any single person on the podcast who hasn't chose this question out of the 20. And the question is, what is your relationship like with fear?
Fear is, for me, is like the best reminder and teacher of priorities, what my priorities are. I don't like to be scared. There's been a time I've like adrenaline junkied a bit for sure, especially right after the thing with the troopers, and I did some really crazy sailing stuff and everything. But when you're scared and you're out of ideas, whatever you're doing, whatever level you're functioning at, that is where I defined me at my best, because that's my baseline operating level. So when I'm terrified and I don't know what to do, I am calling on everything to solve that. And that defines the best of me, the best of my priorities, the best of what I've trained and prepared for. And so I've been scared plenty. And there's a lot of different kinds of fear. Specifically to physical and personal fear, like on the ocean or battling with ice or something like that. Fear in approaching that level where you're scared and out of your where beyond where you should be operating, forces you to come up with a better way to do things. Like Michael J. Fox, I know I didn't ask about the quote question, but I love what Michael J. Fox said. He said, "Strive for excellence. Perfection is God's business." I love that. Because you're like, oh, okay, I get to strive for excellence and let that go. You know, so what's excellent mean? My excellent tomorrow better be better than it is today if I'm worth my salt. And so fear shows me that. So that I think this is one of the reasons, and I love this question because it was the ocean is one of the things that really helped me heal. So when I was out on the third night out, I was on my boat in Pyrkisson, and I'm in Southeast Alaska, and this big bad weather is coming up, and the bowsprit starts plunging into the water. And I was like, yeah. And I went out there and I'm standing on the bowsprit, my feet are plunging, right? And then I hear the engine go, 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 and quit. And I have one fuel filter left. And I was scared. And the ocean was the only place in my life at the time, Warwick, where I could go out there and just throw my anger and all this pent up crap that I had. And it's indifferent to your existence. It doesn't even really know you're there. It's just happening the way it happens. That's why I say you're a guest on the ocean, right? And so the ocean is full of things that can terrify you. And I've got some sea stories that are just fantastic. And we're also absolutely terrifying. But they expose your fear, exposes you, the chinks in your armor. And it exposes, if you were BSing yourself, it's all over it scared. Even if you can mask your fear from others, you know, like that scenario owned you. Like you had no business, you know, making the calls on that because you were at your limit. So I love it because on the ocean, I have a few very basic priorities, and this is always the case. You fix what will kill you first and number one. Number two, you fix what will hurt you, because you might get hurt fixing something that could kill you. And then you fix what will make you more comfortable. And I live by that. Scenario would be you're coming into a dark harbor at night, but you really want a cup of coffee because you've been up for 22 hours. And you are tempted to go downstairs and grab a cup of coffee because you want some comfort, right? But you're making a bad choice because you might run aground because you've been up for a while and you're not really thinking straight, right? So what do I learn from things like that? Number one, sleep. Learn how to sleep. Go offshore and heave too. Have someone who can come with you and like don't approach shore or tight quarters if you're low on sleep. Stay at sea. Like you, so you learn all these different things to keep you out of there. But fear is the thing that slaps you in the face and says, hey, you're screwing up or you're about to screw up. You're operating beyond your license here. And you need to do this thing you're doing, you need to do it better. And so that's my relationship with fear. It's just the greatest teacher. So I don't go looking for it, but I recognize it when I'm like, why am I scared? What is it that I don't know? What is the skill that I do not have that is limiting me and putting me in this fearful position? Or am I just being a reckless jerk? And that's why I'm scared. It's because I just did something stupid. And accept it's one of those two, probably. So I love fear for that. It's, you can't argue with it. It's happening. You're scared. There's a reason.
Yeah, I was looking forward to your answer to that because, you know, I knew I was going to get to that question and listening to all the amazing adventures you've had in your life, I was thinking, I wonder what this dude's like. I mean, he's obviously not scared of fear. You know, what is it? What's the saying? You know, anything to be... The biggest fear is fear of fear itself or whatever. And it sounds like you're not afraid to go into places where you will have some, get to deal with some fear.
Yeah. And that's true. I think that it's inevitable to approach fear and I welcome it for the lessons that it brings. But also if you get out of a bad scenario and all that happened is you were really scared, you got lucky there. And going back into that just to experience fear, I think would be foolhardy.
Mm, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I like it for the lessons, I guess, but I don't go looking for it anymore. I used to, not anymore.
Wow. So it's been almost 2 hours, Jesse, so we better pull it up here, but it's been... an honor and a pleasure to have you on the podcast. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, you work. I hope we see you guys in person at some point.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
And I also want to personally thank you for taking Tyler under your wing and keeping him safe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm giving him some tools, but as you know, he's a quick study. And he's one of those people who he's going to be able to do anything he wants. In life, it doesn't matter. He can be a rocket scientist or whatever he wants to do. He's super bright and he's got a good attitude and he's got good work ethic and he knows how to learn. He's way ahead of the game. His biggest trick is going to be choosing. And that's coming. When he realizes that the world is actually full of like a bajillion really cool ways to spend your life, and he starts doing the math on how long it takes to master things or whatever we call mastering, but get proficient, he's going to have to decide. And because he's so talented, that's going to be tough. That's going to be really tough. I mean, he plays instruments and sailing. And like when I was throwing navigation at him and it just stuck to him like,
oh, really?
You know? Yeah. So what I know about Tyler is that he doesn't need managed. You just kind of aim him in the right direction. You know what I mean? You just like aim him this way and he's going to sort it out. You aim him this way and he's going to sort it out. So what I did with him was just spend some time, encourage him, and then turned him onto some resources. And he has me as a resource. And really, that's how it should be. And that's why I know whatever he does, he's going to, it's going to be full on. So it's really fun. Just fun to be even see on the periphery.
Yeah, he likes to go full send. And so, yeah, it's gonna be fun to see where it goes. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. You guys at home, thanks for joining us on another episode of the Journey On podcast, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.